The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets. My name is Paul Hill, and by popular demand, I'm delighted again to be able to speak to Judith McKenzie of Downing Asset Management, one of the UK's finest small and mid-cap investors. So welcome, Judith.
Good to see you again, Paul.
Yeah, well, actually, it's been quite a surprising start to the year for the stock markets around the world, despite sort of a mini banking crisis and rising interest rates. So putting that together, sort of what's your outlook for equities for the rest of the year?
For the rest of the year, that's way too short term. I mean, I think you've got to be a little bit negative when it comes to the shorter term. The issues that we've had really looming for the last 12 months or so haven't gone away. And they're all the things that we know about. It's inflation, it's interest rates, very topical today, obviously. And it's geopolitical risk. And I can't really see that many of those have disappeared. And I remember sitting in November time and being really depressed about life because of these factors. And actually, you know, they've not gone away. Okay, the market bounced at the start of the year, but actually these factors haven't gone away. So we're quite pessimistic shorter term, but, you know, for the longer term. And actually, I think this kind of market really plays into the hands of stock pickers and also small and micro cap, because you can really get some great earners that are not really correlated to the market. So we're quite bullish about overall being able to pick stocks at this time in the market for the long term. But I think we're going to have a bumpy ride in the meantime, I'm afraid.
Yeah. Well, one thing which has quite surprised, certainly me anyway, is there's been the strength of the consumer, not only in the UK, but particularly out in the US. And we've just gone gangbuster on holidays and spend on sort of consumer and experiences. And, you know, you look at that sort of like, do you believe that one's going to continue, the sort of momentum from the first, from Q1 into Q2, or do you think it's going to sort of like dampen down if interest rates stay high?
Well, I think interest rates are not going to go back to the way that we had them in QE. And I think we've had behaviours that have now been inbuilt for about 10 years or so that we're not really wanting to give up. And I can understand that post-COVID. People do want to get back out there and start spending again on holidays, etc. We're seeing that with the rebound in FX at Ramsden's, for instance. So we're pretty defensive when it comes to the consumer, and we're really being very careful as to where we're putting our money. And I think, you know, just in terms of themes that we're looking at the moment, we're quite keen to look at things that are quite defensive. So we've got some real niche leaders and secular growers. So you're really looking for companies that have got great tailwinds in their own sectors, either through regulation or really just the dynamics of their own sector. Or we're looking for margin and self-help recovery. So basically when companies have got their own levers to pull internally, and we're looking for the good old boring balance sheets that just don't keep you awake at night. So, you know, when we're looking at consumer, we're really trying to make sure that they fall into one of those boxes. And because I do think, well, the government certainly doesn't want us, fiscal policy doesn't want us to be out there spending too much. And I think we will get another interest rate rise today. And I think there's probably another one in the cards for June as well. So I at some point, that's going to dampen down the consumer.
Yeah, well, that's sweet music to my ears as well, sort of like pricing power, defensive positions and good solid balance sheets. Just in terms of so we've had quite a strength on M&A, and we've had a bit of a sort of like rearing its ugly head from the great financial crisis on delistings. Do you want to talk us through, you know, what you see, how that's going to sort of play out, whether we're going to see the continued M&A from largely private equity, and whether we're going to see a pickup in sort of like companies deciding to offboard from AIM?
I think there's two dynamics going on there, unfortunately, and one I'm slightly more negative about. So if you look at the number of companies that are on AIM, for example, about 900 companies at the moment, and over half of those are under 100 million market cap. So, you know, you've got a plethora of companies that are probably not being invested in by institutions. And I think, you know, part of that is to do with institutions becoming more paranoid about that good old word liquidity, and whether that's been driven by the FCA and the regulator. I could probably argue that that is the case. And so it means you've really got a flight away from institutions investing in a 10, 20, 25 million market cap company. We're still there in that space, but I don't know many others that are. So therefore, you're really dependent on the retail investor, very important in today's market. So I think something structurally has to change. I think that the government has to encourage investors, both private and public, to invest in UK small companies, proper small companies, and whether that's through some kind of incentive through a pension benefit of some sort. And also, I think we need to make sure that the market is more efficient and works properly, and that could mean better pricing for those companies lower down the market cap curve. And we're seeing at the moment 1.5 companies a week move from or delist from the market, and that's probably the highest it's been in my time since the start of the year. So I think that's quite a depressing trend. And then the M&A stuff is actually, we've been buoyed up. Our performance has really benefited from that in the last 12 months or so. Well, probably the last 8 months. We've seen our investment trust up about 23% since November, and our IHT portfolios year to date are up about 5 or 6%. So that has been buoyed by some, fortunately, some really good performance. Yeah.
Is that Adept and SureServe?
Yeah, those two were taken out. And I think we're seeing more of that as well. We'll definitely see more of it. It's a bit depressing because Adept, okay, it was a premium of 73% to the price at the time. And I think it was 38% on SureServe. These were good companies that you probably want in your portfolio for the longer term. But yeah, it's very difficult to take that or not take that kind of premium when it comes along, especially in these markets. So I do feel to a certain extent that international companies are getting our companies to a certain extent on the cheap. So a bit depressing as well. But for portfolios.
Yeah, as long as you can sort of redeploy the funds into even better opportunities, and that's good. Just can you just quickly also touch on, because I understand from the latest results that Downey is considering going through sort of like a liquidity event mid next year, I think, if it's got some sort of cash. I don't know how you'd see that as a tender offer or whether it's just a big dividend.
Yeah, I think, you know, we've talked about this a few times in the past. This has always been in since we launched the investment trust, which I think people maybe forget a little bit. It was due to be enacted in, I always get my COVID years wrong now, but yeah, 2021.
Seems a long time ago, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It was a different world, wasn't it? And clearly going through a redemption point and having a facility at that point was just a crazy time to even think about it. So quite rightly, the board moved that point out 3 years, and really supportive of this, because I think just like we are in small companies, we want to see realization. I think if somebody's been in an investment trust for 7 years and it's quite a small investment trust and has grown a little bit, then they want to see some kind of breakout. So it's not unusual to have a redemption facility in place in investment trust. I think Gervais has got one on his investment trust as well, his microcap investment trust. So basically, it's an option. It's great optionality for a shareholder, especially coming in at the moment. So if we are performing well, people stick in. If they're a bit subjective about it, they might take some of their cash out and get that back out at NAV. And actually, if there's a full redemption of that 50%, then there's a strategic review. So in other words, you're going to get performance or something happening either way. So I think that's quite a smart thing to be giving shareholders after 7 years.
Yeah, it won't force you into sell any positions, though. That's the sort of like the key to it.
No, and we're not managing the position. We're not managing the portfolio looking down a barrel thinking, gosh, this is definitely happening. We're managing it on the basis that we're going to drive we're putting our money where our mouth is to a certain extent as well. We believe that we can get the performance that will keep people interested. And I think there will be, just talked about M&A there, haven't we? And in these companies, in this trust, we've been putting in the catalyst, management team have been putting in the catalyst to realise value over the last 2 or 3 years, in fact, 3 or 4 years. So we're really beginning to start seeing these playing out, and no doubt we'll talk about some of those positions going forward as well.
Yeah, well, let's start on one of those then. So Equals, we've got, I know you bought about, I don't know, 6 to 12 months ago, which is an international sort of Forex payments platform that has really gone strength to strength, organic and M&A. Do you want to take us your latest views on that? Because I think it's got a capital markets event next week with a trading update.
Yeah. And it's always nice to see a capital markets day being announced, because you always think that the company is going to hopefully be quite bullish going into that and not reading anything or giving any forecast there. But we're really pleased with the most recent results. And I think there's a real key indicator for us, and that is the revenue per day, which was up about to 340K or thereabouts. And a year ago, that was just about 225K. And here, what we like about it is that Ian's got a really good control of the costs, but he also spends very wisely when it comes to the sales and marketing function. So, you know, every buck is a prisoner with him, or we feel. And that means that you're getting some great operational gearing coming through. And clearly they've got an offering that is pretty unique to the market. And yeah, you know, they're stealing other people's lunches, but they're doing it in such a way that it's a great service offering. So, you know, we're pretty encouraged by it. The revenue was sitting at about 69 million or thereabouts. And, you know, with those KPIs on the revenue per day, we can see the share price. I'm not going to give a forecast, but pretty much doubled from where it is just now.
Yeah, no, I mean, I've got a fair value of 160p and it's at about 90 now. So, and I think Canaccord's at 164 or something like that. So there's plenty of upside. Yeah. Another one which has done tremendous for you, which I think is going to be in that sort of like, you know, realization valley, is Centaur Media, which is a sort of like I think it's a professional publisher in the legal and sort of like marketing areas. Do you want to take us through your latest views on this one?
Yeah, so there's three things that we like about this company. If you look at the forecast cash, about 60 million or so, that would point to a double-digit cash flow yield, free cash flow yield. So it chucks off cash, and it's done that even through, you know, the dark days of COVID and last year. And some cynics would say that this type of company would suffer a little bit through a slightly harder environment. But you've got to remember their marketing spend, or their clients' marketing spend, is above the line. So it's not discretionary, really. So they've got four big brands, but they don't really fit together. I think we might have talked about this before. Yeah. They've got the e-consultancy side, which is a kind of marketing agency type business. They've got the influencing business. They've got the mini MBA, marketing MBA, and they've also got the lawyer, which is, so you've got some marketing brands thrown in with a legal brand there as well. So like, we like the cash generation. We like the fact that they've been really clear on their MAP 23 approach, which is basically saying they'll get 23% margins by 2023. So that's this year. And they're well on track to do it. The last result showed that they were 20-odd% with more to come. And so that's quite a nice thing to put in. And that will give it probably a 12 to 14% free cash flow yield when they achieve that. And then you've also got the lawyer that sits on the side, which is the premium title for the legal industry. So the sum of the parts aspect is quite interesting too. So again, I don't think any of that has really been reflected in the share price that's sitting in the sort of mid-40s at the moment. And I think on a breakup value, you could easily see that being doubled. But actually, even if you value this business on its normal metrics, I think sitting on about 7.5-8 times at the moment, it's the industry players in that marketing space are sitting on about 12 times. So you get the earnings accretion at the same time as a re-rating. And that also gives you a very nice uplift to the share price if there's not a sum of the parts type argument on a breakup.
Yeah, it's got a rock solid balance sheet as well, hasn't it? It's got about 9p per share of cash, I think, on it.
So yeah, yeah.
It's loaded.
Paid out 6.1, I think, in the last year, which is lovely.
Yeah. Just in terms of sort of more broadly, though, with sort of publishing, whether that's across sort of professional or the consumer side, what's your sort of views on sort of generative AI? Because there's been lots of sort of like, you're going to get winners and you're going to get losers, aren't you? Because you had Chegg last week being an online or an ed tech sort of like business that had its shares flattened down 50% because it sort of like gave inclinations that its revenue was being churned out by ChatGPT for students.
Yeah. I mean, we probably ended up investing in things that are going to probably be beneficiaries of Google Chat and AI by accident as opposed by design. But
well done. That's all right. A bit of luck.
Yeah, I know. It's probably a degree of luck there. But it's mainly because they've got IP themselves. And if you look at, say, the lawyer, so lots of people have said that the legal industry is just going to disappear in the next few years. Not great if you're sitting as a trainee lawyer at the moment.
Yeah.
And I maybe don't agree that it's going to go at that kind of pace because I think integrity of data is absolutely everything. And if you look at then at the database that the lawyer has got on case management through hundreds of years, then actually that is protected. It's got its own IP as well. So you can't just nick that off the shelf. So I would like to think that the model will change a little bit and actually maybe to their benefit where they could hopefully get some of the the revenues that could come from feeding into the integrity of data that needs to be improved, I think, before people really adopt it full-heartedly. And the other one that we've got, actually, that has now just gone out of my mind, that is probably geared to that market as well. National World,
which is basically a local publisher, isn't it? It does print media and online.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, you could maybe say that there might be a bit of a threat coming from that side of things. But again, you know, the journalists there are literally the men and women in the street that are seeing, I'm going to be flippant, but seeing the local cat getting run over. And it's very difficult to replicate that kind of local news at a ChatGPT level at the moment. Now, I'm sure there will be feeds into that, but I think the integrity point, as we saw the chief development officer at Google resigning last week, you know, the integrity point, we're all having fun playing with this at the moment, but as soon as somebody gets stung with a bit of data that is fake, really quite fake, but looks as though it's got integrity, then I think there'll be money to be made out of policing that data and understanding where the weaknesses and strengths are. So I do believe there's still going to be a bit of a human element behind it. But it's amazing, isn't it? I'm having great fun playing with it.
Yeah, no, I mean, trying to understand who are going to be the beneficiaries and specifically who are going to be the ones who are impacted and going to be the losers. I mean, there's so much sort of talk that Google itself is going to be a massive loser because it's got 90% search market share. But for another call, I guess. Just on the transition for National World into sort of more online, how is that progressing? Because it's got a bucket full of cash. I mean, it's almost like it's half its market cap is cash, and it's on an 8x PE multiple, which just seems frankly ridiculous. Everybody's betting against it.
The sector, let's face it, is littered with overgeared unionized companies that are really, you know, I'll mention a couple of them, like Reach and others. So you can understand why the perception is that you can't make money out of these types of businesses, but actually, even if you look at how look at the cash generation in something like a Digital Box, which are a complete minnow compared to the titles that National World have got, the digitization side of things is really cash generative, and that's partly the reason that National World is beginning to throw off cash. They've also got some quite precise levers to pull internally on those efficiencies. So I think that, you know, we've been going through a little bit of a perception, but also a bit of a turnaround within National World that the market hasn't quite realised yet. But, you know, as you say, pretty much half its market cap in cash, sitting on a single digit
PE multiple.
EBITDA. I mean, it looks stupidly cheap. And you've got somebody, you've got David Montgomery that's been there and done it before and knows how to run news titles with very, very good folk on the digitization side as well. So yes, it's going to be a transition, still 65-70% on print, but not heavy print where you've got the infrastructure of printing presses and things like that. That's all outsourced, so the model is really pretty lean, keen, and mean. So we expect quite a bit more from that business, probably on the acquisition front as well, I suspect.
Okay, well, it's got plenty of cash, you've got a lot of levers to pull. In terms of another sort of purchase, Journeo, which I think is the CEO is Russ Singleton, who I think you know from presumably because wasn't he the CEO of Synetics as well a long time ago?
So that's going back a while, Paul.
Just going to say, I thought so. It's a familiar name.
Yeah, so Russ was at Synetics before our involvement, right enough, but we did speak to him before we invested in Synetics. But he went on to, he was parachuted into 21st Century, which was the predecessor to Journeo. I think when you go through some turnarounds or whatever, you have to change the company's name.
Yes, you do.
Sometimes to lose the stigma attached with it. So this is a sector that we really like, and it's probably born out of some great experience with a business called Traxys PLC, which is one of the larger exposures that we have in our IHT portfolio. And this sector is just so geared to transport infrastructure, which has been underinvested in the UK in Europe as well for so many years. So, and with Journeo, we've been watching it for a while, but to be honest, it was probably at the kind of too small, not enough growth end of the scale for a while, but we really saw that they'd come through that turnaround, were generating cash, and actually they could be a, quite a decent acquisition vehicle themselves. Mm. And the first acquisition that they came to us with was a business called Infotech that you probably would never have heard of before, but actually is part of our daily lives. So they do the displays. You walk into Paddington Station now, you see the nice coloured displays in Euston.
They do those, do they? Yeah, they are nice, actually. They're much better.
Yeah, quite a big difference, isn't it?
Yeah, huge.
And also the stuff that's at bus stops that tells you that the bus is going to be there in 2 minutes, but probably never arrives.
Yeah.
But it's that kind of management information for the networks that really is quite important. So it's passenger management, it's displays, systems, and Infotech really quite key in that rail network infrastructure as well. Mm. So yeah, they bought it on probably, it was about 2.6 times, either 2.4 or 2.6 times EV EBITDA. So really cheap. And they themselves will be generating about 33 million of revenues and EBITDA of about £4 million, and they've got net cash.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, it's just priced wrong. Again, it's one of those ones that's at the lower end of EV EBITDA at the moment multiples. And we can see this. If you put it on, we're not going to put it on a Tractors multiple because, you know, they're a much more mature business. But even if you put it on a 30% discount to that, then you're looking at over £3 and it's what, £1.70 today. So it's a lot. We really like it. It's a really solid management team that have been through the wars and know how to manage cash. And they could be a little bit acquisitive as well. So I think we own about 6.6% of it now.
Yeah, no, it should be good, reliable sort of recurring revenue streams. Another one which I missed as well is Eagle Eye. Now, I looked at this about it's a digital sort of marketing voucher type of sort of like services, promotions, I think, for large corporates. It sells its software as a SaaS, et cetera. I looked at it about 5 years ago at about £1, and now it's over £5. So you've obviously done really well out of it and re-rated. What's sort of the future, though, going forward for the shares and the company?
Yeah, I mean, it's really sticky revenue. If you can imagine that, you know, we probably see and touch it every day without even knowing, because these are loyalty schemes for the big players.
Yeah.
And we're doing more and more online, and online then goes on to in-store, and being able to incentivize in-store online is a smart thing to do. Again, going back to that point, this is all above the line in terms of marketing. Companies have to do it now to keep us consumers engaged. So it's probably the most expensive thing in our portfolio. We like value and single digit multiples, and that's not what it's on at the moment. Yeah. But I'm not going to put it in the same box as Eagles, but you know, they're very good at consistently over exceeding expectations. Yeah, so you tend to get upgrades. They know how to manage expectations, and they can do that because they've got good long-term contracts. And they, for us to even meet our expectations in terms of the numbers, it's not about necessarily winning new clients. Mm. It's about putting new verticals down that existing client base. So, for instance, as I just talked about, going from online to both in-store, some of their clients are just in-store at the moment. You then start blending that and their margin goes up substantially. So I would put it in the really sort of good quality, secular growth type category. But not the cheapest, and we do keep an eye on the price. Yeah. But it's done as well, and it's a management team that have been there and done it before, ex-Dunnhumby, so you know they know what they're doing.
Oh right, okay, Dunnhumby. Oh right, okay, yeah, they definitely know what they're doing. Then the club card for Tesco's. I mean, you'd have thought it's got to be a beneficiary of the cost of living crisis and people sort of cutting back. They're going to buy if they get a voucher, but they're not going to buy until they get a discount. You know, so.
Yeah.
It should do well. Now, just to go into a couple of turnarounds, real self-help sort of stuff. Inspects, which I think does sort of like, you know, lenses and frames and eyewear, etc., for its own brands, but also for sort of third parties. And it went through, I think it listed about 2 or 3 years ago, did quite well, and then got battered last year, and is now starting to sort of get that semblance of a sort of turnaround. Do you want to tell us your latest thoughts on this one?
Yeah, we don't buy IPOs, but we watched it when it came to market. And what we liked about it at that point was it's in the top 10 worldwide of lens manufacturers. So they've got a dominant market position and have done for quite some time. Mm. It kind of suffered a little bit in the hands of private equity. And, well, you know, it was a COVID IPO, dare I say it.
They haven't done well, have they, generally?
No. So, you know, it had its bad luck and with private equity exiting as well. So it was one of those ones that I'm not saying that every time private equity exits, there's going to be a profits warning, but what there was, and it was quite a dramatic one. So management changed at that point, but they also, they started the self-help measures, and they also started investing, I would say, more efficiently internally. So they've upped their capacity, and they've got some levers to pull that could easily see it being 25 to 30 million EBITDA runway. They're being very, very cautious when it comes to the market, which I think is the right thing to do. But their more recent statement, I don't know if you banged into management at that time, but they're feeling pretty bullish about the levers that they've got to pull, but also just the general macro. They came back, I'm just trying to think of timing. They were a little bit cautious about the German market, consumer market back in November. And we used that as part of our entry point to get into the company. So it's early days with this one for us at the moment, but you never want to market time, but we feel as though we probably got in where market sentiment was against them post-profit warning and also going through a tough time within that German market. But they're, from an operational perspective, we feel as though they're doing all the right things and they got this dominant market share. We could also go into their own stores at some point as well, which would be a real margin enhancement opportunity for them. So yeah, we're, as I say, early days, but quite an interesting one to watch and pretty cheap, very cheap.
Yeah, no, you're right. And also I think that just overall the market, I mean, secular growth as demographics, plus it's not going to get disrupted by AI, is it? I mean, people are going to have problems with their eyes for years and years and years.
I suspect so, you know, staring at screens and stuff like that. Yeah, but that's not going away, is it?
Another one in the sort of healthcare sector, which is going through sort of like an unusual sort of turnaround, is EKF Diagnostics, which is a rock solid sort of, you know, diagnostics business. And then it's branching out into life sciences and was a beneficiary, I think, of COVID, which came off and had a bit of a problem, I think, with its enzyme new startup out in the US. Do you want to take you through your latest views? Because this one has really come down. It's 27 or 28p at the moment.
Yeah. And I think, you know, if I'm being honest, I think probably deserves to be there at the moment.
Yeah.
So they had a real cash win. I think their cash levels went up to about £90 million through COVID because they were doing COVID testing.
That's right.
So a real landfill, an absolute landfill. They made an acquisition at that point it was probably kind of more contract diagnostics and probably hanging off a little bit of the back of the COVID aspect of things. They've actually had to write that down. They've sold it and written it down by £10 million. So, you know, not great, not great. Mm. So, you know, that's £10 million of that 19 that went out the door that could have come back to shareholders. So a bit disappointing. Now, again, though, there's a lot to like here because you've got that core diagnostics business that, you know, 3 to 5% growth in a bad year. And quite good. It's not reoccurring revenue, but it's pretty close to it and a good dominant market share. They use some of their cash to move into fermentation of enzymes. Yeah. And so US businesses trade on crazy multiples and there's a lot of undercapacity. So they brought somebody in to start up that side of the business. Quite different, not absolutely alien, but quite different to the core EKF business. So I would say that is still under review because there's some big lumpy contracts associated with it.
Yeah.
3 or 4 big clients. And they're still in the accreditation phase. The great news is that they got one of their big accreditations on time and on budget just last week. So that's good news. So we're watching that one carefully. It will probably languish at the kind of price that it is at the moment till there's more news flow on the fermentation side over the summer. But I think if you then do the kind of sum of the parts on the core business and the fermentation side, there's definitely significant upside from here, but I think you've got execution risk in the meantime.
Yeah, I did see actually I think it was when they did the presentation, you had the exec chairman, Julian Baines, coming back and he was well committed to sort this business out because it's his baby, I think. He couldn't have
I think he got, I suspect he got hauled back in by the big shareholder, Harwood.
Yeah, another one which is sort of like in that sort of the online media area or is a portal for UK properties on the market. Now, again, it's sort of like the housing market struggled big time last year and lots of the house builders got sold off and Rightmove didn't do so well. Do you want to take you to the latest series of that? Because it's been surprising, actually. The housing market seems to, or prices anyway, seems to have stabilised.
Yeah, when we looked at this one, it was just right in the middle when the housing market was coming off big time and the macro was quite depressed. But what you've got here, so it's a platform, but you've got to remember it's a little bit more than a platform. It's not going head to head against the Right Moves and the Suplus of the world. You know, they've already got the market share. They're they're never going to, on the market's not going to be number one against Right Move. But what they've got is they're cheaper, significantly cheaper. So going into slightly more challenging times, Right Move, because of the monopoly, and Zoopla, because of their monopoly, had really, I would say, been probably charging top dollar to the agents. So On the Market came through, and they, it's actually run by an ex-agent themselves. So that's quite interesting.
Yeah, Jason Tebb, I think.
Yeah, he's quite a character. You always wonder if a chief exec who's an ex-estate agent, you wonder if you're coming away with your fingers or not. But he's really solid. He's really solid. And he knows, he's built this model specifically to cater to the agent that wants to be a little bit more cost conscious. So he actually gives equity away in On the Market to his agents. So you've got a high ownership of On the Market shares within the agency base. So you get that kind of ownership aspect as well. But more importantly, he's cheaper, but they're also pushing down really useful ancillary services to the agents. So making their job a lot easier when it comes to valuations, etc. So very easy for the agent to use. And the platform, as I say, is kind of secondary to it. So I think actually in more challenging times, if you want exposure to this market and in a very cheap way, we think, then actually this is quite an interesting play over the course of the next 12 months.
Yeah, now it's trading on only 9x PE and has got got 10 million of cash, so it's rock solid balance sheet.
Yeah, exactly. And what we were quite reassured, we were looking for liquidity ourselves, and there was a sell down of stock from the agents, so it was much, much less. But that was, I suppose, instigated by the likes of ourselves. That was far less than we expected. So it shows you that the agents do buy into it, they don't want to be sellers.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, to be perfectly honest, I've been struggling just broadly getting, I've got some cash myself and I've been struggling to get in any positions because it's just like the liquidity for a lot of it's just pretty difficult, isn't it? As you talked about earlier. Now, continue on the consumer theme, just a couple of ones. I know it's not in your portfolio, and somebody else's, is Supreme, which the government, it's one of the UK's sort of vaping companies, but it does FMCG products, just lighting and batteries, and does its own sports nutrition, etc. Where, again, came as an IPO 2 years ago or 3 years ago. Now, what's quite interesting, 2 weeks ago, the government decided to give out 1 million free vaping devices to people to get off, sort of tobacco smoking. So it's clearly got a following wind, and it trades on less than 10x PE.
Yeah. These are really smart guys. So they use the, as you say, there's the lower margin, like 10% gross margin type business, which is batteries, lighting, etc. And it was the lighting side that had the profits warning
back last year. Yes, it was.
Yeah, and that was quite an interesting point if you were brave enough to get involved with it. But they use that side of the business as basically a distribution tool to get into the higher margin products like vaping, which is like 30-40% type margins. So they were really very, very shrewd using that network really to push through the higher margin products. And I think, you don't really see that many people at the edge of a building now with a cigarette in their hand. It's it's vaping, and that's everything. So they do own branded, but right the way through to branded as well. Yeah. And they're pretty shrewd. We like their capital allocation. So they bought one brand out of administration for £1.4 million. They very quickly sold that on the licensing rights on.
Yes, that's right. They did, didn't
for
they?
£4 million, four and a half. And then they have got a 5-year manufacturing deal of a minimum volumes of £50 million. Not bad for an investment of 1.4. So I think our entry into that one is, and it's held in Josh's fund, not mine, but our entry into that one was quite good timing, but also identifying the tailwinds within that sector and really trying to get exposure in the small cap. There's not many of those types of companies around.
Oh, yeah, you're right. And I just looked actually at one of the broker reports, Berenberg, their price target's 170 on it. And on a less than 10x PE with a growth, a good, strong growth rate. Yeah. You can see why with operating leverage. Now, another one, which went up and down with COVID is Ramsden's. You mentioned it earlier. And now the Forex seems to be doing well. Gold is obviously, and I presume the pledge book on it, on the pawnbroking side again, is strengthening. What's your latest on Ramsden's?
Yeah, really, really steady. It's a company that, again, is quite a major one in our IHT portfolios, but also in our investment trust. And it's a cracking management team. You know, they're really steady, and they are, you know, they're pretty cautious on new store rollouts. So they've added about 8 or 9 stores this year, but they won't go gangbusters on it. And the payback tends to be anything between sort of 1.5 and 2.5 years in these stores. And their store buying directors are really very, very savvy. For the first time, they're going further south. So you might remember their heartland before was that kind of northern corridor. They're based in Middlesbrough themselves.
Yeah.
And I'm speaking from Scotland, and they're pretty much on every high street in Scotland, unlike H&T, who don't have as much of a presence. So they're now going a little bit more selectively into that southeastern area. Something that we've challenged them on quite a few times, but they feel that there's certainly enough room for their FX offering in particular, alongside the pawnbroking side, sitting alongside an H&T, for example. So the FX now is back to 70% of COVID, pre-COVID levels. And I see that getting, we just talked about, you know, people going on holiday and stuff like that. I can see that getting back to well in excess of COVID levels, actually. And they've actually won market share. And because there've been quite a few players coming out of the market, their margin's gone up on that side of the business as well. And the bit that surprised me, actually, and where I was pretty cynical talking about that consumer point, has been the jewellery side of the business. That's up about 50% in the last 12 months. And actually on the last quarter, again, has shown quite a dramatic improvement. So they've now become in the top 5 of secondhand and new jewellery retailers. If you want a Rolex, that's the place to go. And that's really geared by their online offering as much as anything else. So I'm really bullish about the FX side. I'm bullish about the pawnbroking side for all the macro reasons that we talked about. And I'm bullish about the gold buying and selling side. I'm a little bit cautious about the jewellery side, but again, you know, it's not a major part of their business, growing part of their business, and they're quite careful operators. So that I don't think they'll end up stupidly overstocking. And they've got this regional network that they can sell through as well. So you've got both online and in store. So yeah, I don't think it's going to double from here, but I think you could probably see a good 30 to 40% growth in share price over the next 12 months with a solid management team that keep delivering. So it's got a real place in the portfolio.
Yeah, I mean, it's a counter-cyclical play, 10 times PE, and H&T yesterday put out a pretty positive trading update. So I suppose that underpins, actually, why they want to go into the southeast if H&T are sort of like doing well, other than the competition-wise. Just got to be careful, haven't you? Yeah. Now, just another one, which my father actually says big thanks to you, is Ashted Technologies, which has been an absolute sort of home run to you guys, because you were the first person that I spoke to about 12, 18 months ago who pointed it out, and the shares have been flying, really, on upgrades.
Yeah, I think we like to try and identify companies that have been overlooked a little bit. And this is another one that came to market, about 2 years ago,
maybe two and a half years ago. Yeah.
But you know, I've started using the word fungible, which I'd probably never used before I'd met Ashted. Nick Hawthorne, my colleague, leads on this one, and he loves that word fungible. But basically, what it means is that they're buying bits of kit. Like some hire businesses go out and buy 50 grand or more, 500 grand bits of kit, and then hire them out, and you get damage to them, and it really is all about utilization. But their bits of kit are between 5 and 10 grand, and so therefore you can get some really good utilization and turnover with them in them. And the fungible aspect is that they can be serviced both in the renewables and the oil and gas sectors. Yeah. So guess what? Offshore renewables, it's in the news today that we don't have enough cables actually to put into the grid. You know, that area of the market is a real growth area, as actually now is the oil and gas and oil and gas decommissioning. And you know, I'm always proud to say that in our portfolio we've got companies that are absolute world leaders in their fields. And Ashted is one of those as well. You know, serviced out of Aberdeen, or many sites, but mainly out of Aberdeen. And you know, you can go on site there and you can literally go and see how much kit is lying about the yard, and you know, when Nick goes to visit, you can see that there's not a lot about. Yeah. So, you know, utilization rates have been pretty high. So it's quite an easy one to understand and measure with the tailwinds that we've talked about. And I think now it's also, it's come of age when it comes to larger shareholders or getting onto the radar of potential larger shareholders. And hopefully we'll be with it all the way through its journey. But I think it probably, you've got the earnings growth coming through that that is, you know, it's great, just been ahead of our expectations. And I think you're going to get that re-rating, or we're beginning to get that re-rating as well. So it's been a really good call by Nick on that one.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, tip hat to the to Nick, because I know I spoke to the CEO, Alan Price, I think it is, Alan Peary, about sort of like 12 months ago. And he was in Aberdeen, because I think that's where their head office. And he said he just can't believe the amount of activity in Aberdeen with the helicopters coming in and out and all this sort of stuff. And, anyway, my father made some good money out of it. So that's very nice. That's right. Now moving to a couple of others, which are sort of like one's a bit of a turnaround and taking quite some time. Is Flowtech Fluid Power, that I think has now got a new CEO in, which may have the print of a bit of Downing in there. I don't know, but what's your sort of latest view on this? It's a distributor of all things sort of like, you know, fluid and pneumatic power sort of parts and services for industrials, I guess.
Yeah. Well, we can't really take the credit for the new CEO, but I think definitely the right thing to do. It's been, so the investment case here is very simple. It's a bit like an Amazon for, as you say, pneumatic parts and whatever, and servicing a multitude of industries, so not just dependent on automotive or whatever or just industrial. So it's a great exposure to European and worldwide industrials. So that's nice sector of growth to get exposure to. But the turnaround aspect of it was that they were building new efficiencies to their website and also just to their operating structure. So here, it really, the key is getting the stock turnover, and that's really what drives your margin. And I think, they were affected by COVID a little bit, obviously, with that downturn. But they also have probably been a little bit slower in getting that margin benefit coming through because of that stock turnover not just going to the levels of our expectations. You know, still hitting market expectations, but probably not quite growing at the rate that we believed it could. So I think this new management has got a bit more of a tilt towards that operational drive, being able to get just got a call coming in there. I'll get rid of.
That's right.
Yeah, sorry about
that. That's Nick again, isn't it?
Yeah, gosh, just, I can't get him off the phone sometimes talking about Ashton. Yeah. Nightmare. There's definitely a benefit, I think, to come through over the course of the next 6 to 12 months. So one that we're looking at closely, not quite done what we wanted it to in terms of share price. It's probably more affected by the headwinds of COVID than we had hoped, but I think the right tools in the toolbox to drive that margin back up to sort of 9% from where it is now.
Yeah, I guess if they can actually stock some more, in your term, fungible parts, which are going to be fast moving rather than slow moving, then that will just absolutely energize the sort of cash generation, because the inventory will be able to sort of bring it down and get more cash thrown out. Another one on Volex. I know we've talked about it quite a bit. It sort of like did really well and has come back down, and it's on about 11 times PE. It's got quite a bit of debt, actually, after a recent acquisition. Do you want to take us through your sort of like how you view this one?
Yeah, it's still really positive. It looks cheap, good quality business. Again, looking at these tailwinds from a sector point of view, you've got EV in there, you've got healthcare, medical. So they're in all the right sectors, and they've got a very good international network to be able to service their client base. So I think structurally they're in the right place. I can understand where the share price came back a bit. You know, the gearing went up, and then working capital got snarled up a little bit.
Right.
When I say snarled up, you always get a bit of a time lag effect, don't you? But the market doesn't like that. But I think the most recent update really shows that working capital is has been unwound and is reducing debt in the way that we were hoping that this would play out. So no, actually pretty bullish about it now. And I think over the course of the last sort of week or couple of weeks, we've started to see more people looking at it again, because it looks cheap from for the type of growth that you're going to be able to get from this. I think anything with debt, even if it's, you know, at the 2x EV EBITDA level or just slightly above it, is getting the cynic looking at it. And so therefore you've got to prove that you're capable of generating that cash to pay down the debt. If you don't, then you're going to, I think, be stuck in a bit of a no man's land.
Yeah, no.
So, fortunately, we've seen that with Rolex more recently, which is great. It's good.
Yeah. And what was also quite, it's a pretty big business now. I mean, it's over $750 million sort of turnover. I mean, that's a nice bite size for private equity, that is. But hey, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think so. You know, you've got one dominant shareholder there.
Yeah. Okay. So,
and I think, yeah, he can definitely see the growth that's coming from the acquisitions that were bedded in through the course of the last 18 months or so. But it's got to be a takeout.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, look, it looks a good chunky size business for somebody to, you know, private equity house with a bit of spare cash. Look, yeah. On a cheap valuation, I don't know. I mean, you know better than I, but it certainly just on the optics, it would look an interesting target for somebody with a financial slide rule. Now, just another area that's doing a lot of sort of consolidation, asset managers, and you've got two in your portfolio that are really doing pretty well. Tatton, let's move on that one. Just take us through sort of Tatton asset management, because the whole sector's been sold off, but these seem to be the baby in the bathwater.
Yeah, I think so. You know, this one is, so when we look at this sector, we've got exposure, I suppose, through, when I say exposure, we've got knowledge through our own investor base who tend to be IFAs. Mm. So most institutions would be speaking to pension funds or some of the larger guys out there. But when we're speaking to our own investors, we're getting on a train, we're going up to Leeds, Harrogate, whatever, and we're seeing the smaller IFA. So we're quite in tune with the dynamics that are going on in that market. And Tatton really is the absolute golden child of that IFA space. What do they do that's smart? They're cheaper. Mm. They're very, very efficient, very cheap, but their service offering is really good. And that's what a regional IFA wants. I'm not talking about the big discretionary wealth managers. And their performance is pretty much in line with what you get on, you know, elsewhere, if not slightly above. But it really is that service offering and the cost base that they're selling on. They've got a little bit of mortgages as well that tends to muddy the water a little bit. But, you know, really their core business is that wealth management side and that IFA client base. And they've got their own IFAs as well. So, you know, I think they're a very well-run business. They've got net cash in the balance sheet. And I think, you know, you look at the market forecasts, then, you know, we're about, what, 4.50 or something today, but you can see that being the over £6. Just if you look at the metrics of some of the bigger discretionary wealth managers and their valuations that are on sort of 2% of AUM, and we're sitting on probably about 1.4, 1.5. So, you know, I think there's a good way to go in this one. It's one of those solid ones that we have in IHT. It's also held by Rosemary Banyard. He's held it probably for 5 years longer than I have. So she knows it pretty well.
Yeah. So in the whole industry, it looks a pretty unique asset, trophy asset. So I wouldn't be surprised if somebody decides to hoover that one up. That's for sure. Giving them something quite, you know, differentiated, isn't it? And then the other one, which is differentiated, is Frenkel Topping. And I remember speaking to Christopher Mills about this one, and he loves it. So I think you're in good company. What's your sort of latest view on Frenkel Topping? Again, very differentiated sort of like asset manager and financial services provider.
Yeah. So I looked at this one quite a few times over the years, and Christopher probably wouldn't like me saying it, but I always viewed it as a bit of an ambulance chaser, because what they're doing is they're taking case management in for somebody that might have been run over by a bus, getting an insurance claim, helping them out with that claim, and then actually handing them on to their financial services side. So although we've got two financial services businesses, and you maybe wonder why we've got that exposure, you've got two very, very different exposures. So you've got good old Tatton, that's the IFA market, and then you've got Frenkel, where you've got case management, legal, and the IFA side put in as well. So you really are, you're with our client from cradle to grave, or at the start of their journey, literally from accident right the way through to getting hopefully a decent claim for their accident and being able to manage it for the long term. Completely different type of financial services exposure. So we got involved when they were pretty much part of that journey in building what they've got now. And I would say, I think there's probably a few other little bolt-ons that they can do, but they've largely got that infrastructure in place to basically double their revenues over the next 5 years. And they were brave enough to come out with a statement basically saying that in their recent results. I think people were looking for a direction of travel. And that really means that, you know, you're getting this business on a very, very cheap multiple if you're looking at that operational gearing that this company is capable of. So, yeah, slightly different exposure in the financial services space, but I think you've got to be a little bit aware of the macro and not just go into a Brooks McDonald or whatever because you think it might get taken out. I think both of these businesses will get taken out at the right time, but you've also got some great earnings growth that will come through. But more importantly, I think as these companies get recognised, you'll get a re-rating as well.
Well, you've got some, I mean, just looking at the, say, the portfolio, you've got some fantastic value opportunities there, a lot of self-help, et cetera. So even though you're sort of cautious about the macro, you must be reasonably quite positive about your portfolio, aren't you? I mean, you can do see a lot of idiosyncratic risk there, which can outperform the market.
Yeah, I mean, dare I say it, we were quite happy when the whole QE aspect started coming away because we've been value investors for the long term. Our IHT portfolios are up over 150% over the last 10, 12 years. That shows you that value works. AIM's up about 19% over the same period. So it shows you that value works over the long term, but really works in this kind of market environment where you can be a stock picker for these great quality companies that you're buying on single digit PEs. So you know, I can be negative, as I said at the start, about the short term and just the headwinds of macro over the course of the next 6-12 months or so. But, you know, we're buying these companies now and we're getting the growth that we believe can come out of them without the market having to help them. Then actually, you know, we're going to be in quite a good position.
Good. Yeah. And if investors want to sort of like join the value and the GARP sort of like stock club, et cetera, with Downing, how best to invest in the sort of funds there? Is it best to sort of contact you or the website?
Yep. www.downing.co.uk. You always put me on the spot on this one. I can never remember what it is, but give me a shout, judith@downing.co.uk, and we'll point you in the right direction without giving you any financial advice, of course.
Okay, fantastic. Well, look forward in touching base again in 6 months' time and hearing a few more of how you're deploying that sort of the cash with a few sort of new toeholds. So thanks again, Judith, and best of luck.
That's great. Thank you very much.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.